Welcome to Press On Podcast with Mike Woodruff, where Mike and invited guests share insights to cultivate a biblical perspective and thoughtful resilience in challenging times.
Welcome back to the Press On Podcast. My name is Mike Woodruff, and today we are going to entertain some questions about the book of Exodus. So this podcast grows out of the sermon series that we're doing at Christ Church right now, which is on Exodus. It's a great book. Love the book. Exodus is enjoying a bit of a renaissance all of a sudden. I mentioned that in the first sermon in this series, that suddenly everybody, and not just pastors, but a lot of public intellectuals or people in that pundit space are spending time on the book of Exodus. And I think that's because as Western civilization is shaking right now, that may be too strong of a verb, maybe not strong enough, but anyway, as there is just a lot of angst and things are unsettled and society is confused and there's some chaos out there, a number of people are going back and looking at the Jews and looking at the nation of Israel and looking at their staying power and saying, okay, what is it about the Jews? What is it about the West that has had this kind of trajectory? So it goes, the book of Exodus, in a sense, is the start of the nation of Israel. And so you have all the formative kinds of issues, and it's a country of, you know, rule of law and all that stuff. And there's just an opportunity here to reflect on what does it mean to be a people, a nation, and all of that. So we're going through it basically a chapter a week, and that's moving too quickly for me to take up some of the questions that arise from the text. And so we were going to do a Q&A after the sermons every, you know, once a month or something like that. And we've done that in the past, but while that tends to work pretty well at the Lake Forest campus, it's a little suboptimal for the other campuses. And because of that, we decided that we weren't going to do Q&A after the sermon. We were going to go ahead and I would film this podcast. So you may know that there are podcasts out there in which podcast hosts do these AMAs, Ask Me Anything. And there tends to be, with these AMA podcasts, a little bit of a vibe that is, you know, this is all top of mind for me. And some that I've heard, the podcaster wants it to be very clear that they have not heard these questions in advance. Look, that's great. That's not what I am doing. I am not able to do that. Some people are great at that. Some people are not great at it, and they try to do it. And I think that's obviously less than ideal. But I envy those people who are able to really quickly, you know, sort of congeal their thoughts and dispel them in a quick manner that is good. I need some time for my brain to sort things out. I heard a little while ago that your memory starts to fade in part because it just takes longer for your reference librarian to access the files. So when you're young, your reference librarian in your brain is very young, and you ask it a question, and there's not many books or files or, you know, archives for the reference librarian to access, so they do it quickly. You get older, more mature, I'm 62, and your reference librarian is a little bit older, and he or she has old creaky knees, and you ask that person a question, and they sit there for a while, and then they finally decide to get up, and they have to stretch and get their legs moving, and then they head back into the archives, which are now far bigger than they were when you were 5 or 6 years old. And it will be a while sometimes before they get back to you with the information. I regularly now have the occurrence in which 2 or 3 days after I see someone, their name pops into my head. I'm thinking, there's that person. What is their name? What is their name? What is their name? Well, you know, I have made a request of the librarian, but the librarian does not act very quickly. And by the time they get back to me, it's a couple days have passed. So the information is there. It just takes longer to get to it. So I find it helpful to actually spend a little bit of time in advance thinking about my answers to these questions. I am not, by the way, I am not a debater. Most pastors are not. I always cringe when a pastor agrees to debate somebody like, you know, I don't know, Christopher Hitchens or whoever. Because that's just, first of all, it's just not the skill set that pastors develop. We don't develop the skill set of you know, fielding questions or being involved in a lively debate. So I'm very happy to report I've never actually lost a public debate. But that's because I don't do public debates. I say, hey, if you got a question, you know, let me know and I'll give you my top of brain thinking. But what I prefer is to be able to cogitate on it for a little bit or to just, you know, go out and look what's on the internet or pull a book off the shelf or call a friend, you know, call a lifeline and say, hey, I just got asked this. I'm thinking this. What are you thinking? How would you answer that question? So, by the way, this is a little bit of far afield, but when it comes to debates, when I was a college pastor, we used to regularly host debates. And I came to the conclusion at that point, watching good debates, good debaters, good Christian apologists fielding debates, you know, engaging in debates with, you know, people that were denying that God existed or arguing, you know, that science disproves Christianity, whatever it was, that these debaters needed to be not just, you know, really smart and quick, but also, you know, loving and winsome. So we had William Lane Craig debate a biologist, I think, and it was on the question of, you know, science disproved Christianity. And it was a, you know, we packed the place, 1,000 students. And Dr. Craig did great. He's so smart. I really, when I look back, I always cringe because the professor, the biology professor, when I asked him if he would debate, you know, engage in a debate, he said, not on the college campus. I'll debate, but only if we have it at your church. We met about half mile off campus. And only if we meet at your church, because I don't think that the university is a place to engage in these types of questions. So I obviously profoundly disagree with that. I think the university is exactly the kind of place where we ought to be raising these first questions, you know, what matters, who am I, you know, does God exist? And we really lost. I think higher ed really suffers when it doesn't engage these first questions. But agreed that those were conditions of the debate, that it had to take place at the church. So the first thing this guy does when he gets up to offer his remarks is he says, look, I just want to be clear. I'm here on hostile ground because, you know, that's where this debate was supposed to take place. And I'm thinking, absolutely not. You complete. Then he went on to say, by the way, he says, I talked with Mike Woodruff. He's a very reasonable guy. Well, we had chatted for a while, and I want to think I'm a reasonable guy, but I kept saying to him, because he kept saying to me, I you know, you strike me as an educated person. He was saying that because he thought Christians were idiots and kept saying, I'm sure you don't understand the views that I'm trying to persuade. So anyway, all that to say, we used to do lots of debates. Dr. Craig would do a brilliant job technically answering the questions. I came to really appreciate, we had a guy, a British guy, Michael Green, who was just so, he was very smart, Oxford grad, and he wrote a bunch of books, but he was very engaging and warm, and he would, you know, a lot of humor. And I loved all that. That was not me. I don't do debates. So, a long way of saying, I have heard these questions in advance. You sent them in. So I'm answering some of the questions. We'll have to do this again because I got more questions than I've got time to answer, especially if I'm going to go on these long tangents. But so you sent in questions, and I'm going to those. I've organized them a little bit to sort of front load some of the biggest questions about Exodus. I also was asked questions. You didn't sort of formally send them in, but after sermons, I got sent, you know, people would just come up to me and go, what about this? What about that? Whatever. So I've included those. And then I've included some questions that you didn't ask, but I sensed that you were trying to ask. So some of these questions are sort of apologetic in nature, that word apologia in Greek, the defense of the faith. They're more, you know, is Christianity true kind of thing. Some of the questions are a little bit more pastoral or personal. So we're just taking them as they come. And one more thing just about questions in general, and that is I want to just endorse the idea of asking questions. I think, first of all, that the quality of our life pivots a little bit on the kinds of questions we're asking. But I also think that it's important to note that we shouldn't be scared of questions, and that that I want people to feel free to, you know, to raise questions and objections. I think some Christians are scared to ask questions because they're scared that perhaps their faith is going to unravel. I think that there are some churches, and I was in a setting 25 years ago where it became clear at some point that if I kept asking questions, that that was not a good thing, that it was seemed to be a little bit of lacking faith or having a critical spirit or whatever. And I don't want that to be the vibe that you get at Christ Church or with me. Appreciated very much the first professor I had of theology, Dr. Ken Conser. Harvard guy. He was the, at the time that I had him, it was towards the end of his career. He had been the founding dean of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. He was the editor of Christianity Today. And he just said, it's important that we ask these questions. He noted that we can't answer all the questions that we ask. We sometimes can't understand it. God is bigger than we are. We're not going to fully grasp God, his character, the mysteries of God, and also to note that that in some cases we need to understand that truth does not depend upon our ability to understand it. So that's a longer topic, but he suggested that when you run into a question that you can't answer, that you put it in what he called his mental icebox, a refrigerator, basically. He was older, and he said he still refers to the refrigerator as an icebox, but he said, put it in the mental icebox. And from time to time, you can take these questions out and look at them again. You've learned more. There's been more research done. You get different answers out there, and you start to work some of these things out, which can be very encouraging for your own faith. So, after that long introduction, let me take up question number one. Does it matter whether or not the Exodus actually happened? So I say, yes, it does matter, and I am going to say, yes, that it happened. So look, the book of Exodus is this founding book. It is this founding narrative about Western civilization and the nation of Israel, the Jewish people. So you get this whole idea here, right, of a rule of law. And there's again, so much that happens in the book of Exodus that I'm saying points ahead to Jesus and to Jesus being the true and better Moses and all of this stuff. So I think it does matter. Now, so you know, there is a school, there's a branch of theological liberalism, and again, I'll remind you that theological liberalism is a thing. I'm not just talking about theological progressives. So the term liberal gets used in a lot of different ways. When it's capitalized, it refers to a particular branch of theology, to a school of thought. Think Rudolf Bultmann and others of that, Schleiermacher to some extent. But there were a group of people who would say, and this was this sort of 18th century, 19th century people who were looking at the world and looking at Enlightenment thinking, coming to second guess the Bible and theology and all of this. And their approach to this was to say, it doesn't matter whether or not the Exodus happened. It matters whether or not you believe it happened, or it matters whether or not you have the faith that it happened. Okay, it doesn't matter whether Jesus existed. It doesn't matter whether the resurrection occurred. The question is, do you have faith? Can you believe that a story like that might occur? Okay, so I first ran into this early as a pastor. I was preaching, I'm sure it wasn't Easter, but I was preaching a resurrection sermon probably in the weeks leading up to Easter on whether or not there's evidence for the resurrection. Classic sort of basic apologetic approach. The tomb is empty. What happened? You know, well, did the disciples steal the body? Did Jesus not really die? Just swooned? Did they go to the wrong grave? All those things. So I finished preaching. I'm, I don't know, 25, 26. And a woman approached me. This is at First Presbyterian Church in Bellingham, Washington. And this woman approached me. And she said, it doesn't really matter whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. And I remember saying, well, I think it does. The Apostle Paul certainly says that it does. In 1 Corinthians 15, he says, right, if Christ didn't rise from the dead, our faith is in vain. And she said, yes, Paul had the same problem you have. It doesn't matter if it happened. The important thing is the truth behind the story. And I was really quite shocked by this at the time. And in defense of this woman, I got to know her, and she was very bright. And she was very committed. And I remember one of the things that she said was, I'll go to your prayer meetings, but only if after the prayer meetings, you'll go with me out into the alleys and we feed the poor. And I came to really appreciate that aspect of her. She goes, all these people want to go to prayer meetings. They never want to actually, you know, care for the poor. The Bible talks about prayer, but it also talks about feeding the poor. And so I came to appreciate aspects of her, but I think theologically she was wrong. I'm not in the Schleiermacher Bultmann camp. You get a little bit also of this with Jesus, the Jesus Seminar people, Marcus Borg, the quest for the historical Jesus, right? They're going to say that the historicity of these things doesn't matter. The question is more about faith or whatever. So I am not in that school of thinking. I believe that the Bible presents itself as a historical work. It doesn't say a long time ago in a faraway land. It sort of tries to ground these accounts in actual events. Now, within the Bible, there are stories. A classic case would just be the parables that Jesus tells. These stories are not historical events, right? And it's quite clear. There's a couple situations where it's not entirely clear whether the story Jesus is telling actually happened or he's made the story up. So there are those kinds of things. I think it's also, I'm willing to entertain that some of the accounts that we find in the Bible are summaries, and you know, they're simplifications of things that are happening in order to communicate something. However, by and large, I view the Bible as a book that is true in what it's claiming, and that the events that are being reported as historical events are historical events. So I talk about this a little bit in the upcoming book, my book that's about to come out. So filming this in October of 23. And I think we're hoping that the book will be out in November, maybe not till December. But anyway, the book is titled, How Do You Know? And it looks at epistemology. How do we know what we know? How do we answer the big questions? And I argue in that book, basically, for the Bible, right? That we've got to, among the sources of truth, sources of authority that shape our life, reason, revelation, tradition, and experience. Obviously, we recognize validity and truth in all of these, and it's we're never 100% one and 0% the other three. I mean, we're always playing with all four of these sources of authority. The question is, how do you arrange them and all of that? So it's a little bit more complicated. But I say in there, when people ask me if I read the Bible literally, what I used to say when they'd ask me that question was, of course, don't you? In more recent days, when people ask me that, I've changed my answer, and they say, do you read the Bible literally? I now say, well, that depends. Do you have a literal interpretation of literal? Or do you have a more metaphorical interpretation of literal? And usually people back up at that point, and then I go down this path and I say, look, the literal definition of literal, if we're going to go to the Latin word literali and say it's according to the letter, then we're recognizing that we have to interpret things according to the genre in which they've been written, and that the first thing we're trying to do when we're reading something is to understand what the writer wants us to understand. And in the Bible, we're trying to understand what the original writer intended the original readers to understand. And so obviously you interpret parable differently than you do prophecy, different than you do apocalyptic, differently than you do chronology, differently than you know, there's all kinds of different literary genre in the Bible. So you have to interpret the Bible according to the genre of the text that you are reading. And I generally just say all that to say I have a very high view of Scripture. I'm trying to model or imitate the interpretation or the understanding that I believe Jesus had. And he has a very high view of Scripture. And for Jesus, of course, when he's talking about the Bible, the Law and the Prophets, when he's talking about, you know, every jot and tittle is true, he's not talking about the New Testament because that hasn't been written yet. He's talking about the Old Testament. And there are cases in the Gospels where Jesus makes it clear that he sort of believes what Moses writes, that Moses has written the book of the Pentateuch, written the book of Exodus, and that Moses' reference to the Exodus and the events of the Exodus, the Passover, are true events and that he's fulfilling them. So, if you're asking me the question, does it matter whether or not the Exodus occurred? I would say, I think it does. Yes, I believe that it does. Then there's a second question. Is there evidence that the book of Exodus or that the Exodus described in the book of Exodus actually occurred? So, yes, I would say there is evidence. Now, the evidence is going to be different for different people. I take the Bible as evidence. Because I believe, again, that the Bible is what it claims to be, the Word of God, and that rightly interpreted, it's always true in everything that it claims, you know, down that path. I don't engage in debates. Well, I don't engage in debates. I certainly don't engage in debates over the topic of inerrancy. I just generally, as a pastor, it's not my lane. I'm trying to get people to read the Bible. I'm advocating the authority of the Bible. I'm claiming that the Bible is the Word of God, and I'm trying to get people to read the Bible because I believe, to quote C.S. Lewis, that you defend the Bible like you defend a caged lion, you open the cage. Let the Bible defend itself. I think when people start to read the Bible, the Bible starts to read them, and then this is different. I'm not engaging in debates, fine-tuned theological discussions about inerrancy and those things. It's not the world I live in. But I believe that the Bible is true. So the first answer to the question, is there evidence for the Exodus? I would say yes, and I would point to the Bible. Now, I don't think that's the way the question was asked. I think the question is being asked is there extra-biblical evidence for the book of Exodus? And I don't understand or assume necessarily expect that religion professors are going to grant the Bible any kind of authority. That's not what university is doing today. It started that way. Higher education started in the United States and arguably in Europe to a little bit lesser extent. But early on, these are church-based projects. Harvard was started by Christians to train pastors, and the early creed, the early founding documents are all about, you know, we want everybody to trust Christ and to grow in faith and to be zealous in their pursuit of Jesus. And that's true of almost all the early colleges that got started. But that's not what's going on today. We're post-Enlightenment. And so the university project today, people are expected to be dispassionately scientific. Of course, we have all kinds of issues with that today because we've got all kinds of new cancel culture laws and people who are going to argue on the basis of different kinds of epistemological assumptions. But by and large, you're supposed to be able to use the scientific method or something related to that to sort of study a text. So the question then becomes, when a religion professor, somebody who doesn't start with a belief in God and is studying the Bible, it's not a theology project, it's not a Bible study, it's more of a sociological or anthropological discipline. We're going to start by looking at people, and then we're going to look at the religious artifacts of people. When they look at the book of Exodus, do they find historical verification for it? So now we're entering a different realm of proof. And by and large, we're going to enter into, for the most part, we're going to enter into the world of historical proofs and archaeology. So are there historical proofs? So certainly the many Jewish scholars would argue that there is, and they would argue on the basis of perhaps what actually seems to have happened, or oral tradition, or things like that. In terms of archaeological finds, a couple things to note. First of all, I was naive as to the way archaeology works until I started to go to Israel, and archaeology is a huge, there's like 30,000 archaeological sites in Israel, active sites, because, I mean, you're building in Israel on a culture that's, 5,000 years old, and the Department of Antiquities for the Nation of Israel is a huge department, and at one point, I heard that it was second in funding only to the military. I can't believe that's still true today. But if you're going to remodel your kitchen, the Department of Antiquities comes by every day to ask what you found, because if you start to dig in Jerusalem, you're going to find stuff. And you're going to go down through all the strata, and you're going to be finding things. So, but all that to say, the interpretation of what you find and what it means is subject to your worldview. There's political influences. There's theological influences. There's schools of thought within historical, you know, fields that lead you to interpret what you find in the dirt differently. And so archaeology is hotly contested. The Jericho site, supposedly one of the oldest cities of all time, that you stop by in Jericho. You go to Jericho if you go to the Holy Land, and but it's underground, and that's in part because this is now on the West Bank, and the Palestinian archaeologists are not inclined to want to do work. This is so contested. I'm going to get in trouble. As soon as you start to talk about the Middle East, you get in trouble. But you could understand that if there was evidence in the excavation of Jericho that the Jews were trying to reassert themselves in this land and doing so thousands of years ago, that then the Jews could argue some historical claim to the land and that they should get this, the West Bank should all be theirs. And that's not anything that Palestinian archaeologists would be interested in. And I'm not trying to pick on the Palestinians here, but I'm just noting. And also, by the way, the most important archaeological site on the planet would be the Temple Mount. And it's not being excavated, right? Because it's so hotly contested. Who knows what you would find? And there is now, this last time I was in Israel, I went finally to the tunnels that are under the Temple Mount that are relatively new finds, relatively new, you know, 20 years old. But you can now go down under the Temple Mount. This is sort of space that the Israelis, that the Jews can excavate, that is not controlled by the Jordanians and the Muslims. But the whole place is, I mean, it's if an archaeologist could do work anywhere, they would want to do work there. But it's not being done because it's so political. So when it comes to the archaeological finds, when it comes to the Exodus, the first things you got to understand is it's contested. The second thing you have to understand is we're trying to go back here 3,500 years. So I just was listening to a podcast, and when the question was being asked, this was not a religious biblical podcast. The question was being raised: how much evidence, hard evidence, do we have for somebody like Caesar? Well, there's all kinds of evidence. I mean, nobody doubts that Caesar existed. We've got his writings. We've got the writings of all his contemporaries, Cicero and other people. You've got Coin Age. You got all this stuff. You've got archaeological stuff. When it comes to actual physical stuff that you can touch that points immediately to Caesar, the answer is not much. And that just takes us back 2,000 years. So with the Exodus, you're trying to go back 3,000, 3,500 years. And so there is an argument to be made that we don't have a lot of archaeological evidence. So, and by the way, just on this, I'm being loquacious today. I'm being ADD today. But on this whole issue of how political archaeology is, a friend who's a PhD student in Canada right now, he's Canadian, and he's doing PhD work in Canada, and you know, about a year ago, there was this discovery or claim that there were these unearthed graves. There was this disturbed soil around all of these schools in Canada, and the suggestion was that there were a lot of indigenous First Nation Canadians who had been sent away from their parents and sent to these schools, and that they died. And I didn't follow the story closely, but I knew it was a big topic in Canada. And then I read this article that was claiming that because this was a huge issue in the and most of these schools were Catholic schools, and the Pope was coming to Canada to apologize for the Catholic Church's part in these horrific events. So then I'm reading this article at some point, I don't know why or how, but I'm reading this article that says, wait, we don't have any actual physical evidence of this, and none of these supposed graves have been unearthed, and there's no reason to think that this happened. And so I sent this article to my friend in Canada, who's, again, doing a PhD. And I said, hey, what do you make of this? Again, not my field. I know nothing about this. But I read this article and I'm like, hey, I've been following this in the Canadian news and now I read this, you know, what's the truth? And he writes back to me and he says, are you trying to get me kicked out of my PhD program? I deleted your text. I deleted your link. We can't talk about that stuff here. That the indigenous people would say, look, these burial sites are sacred ground. You cannot go in and excavate and find out if these are graves or not, and find out who's buried there or not, and doing DNA testing or not. And so I just note, a lot of this is for political as well as theological and philosophical and worldview issues. There's a lot of this stuff that is just, archaeology is now political. So who knew, but it is. So is there evidence for the Exodus? I would point initially to the Bible. I would also point to the whole Jewish nation and the formation of Jewish culture and rule of law and all of that. And then I would also say there's a lot of excavations going on that seems clearly to point in the direction of the biblical story. And if you get a chance to go to the Holy Land, you can see a lot of this stuff there. So I am going to argue that there is evidence for the nation of Israel. We obviously don't have the Red Sea parted. Is there evidence for Jewish people living in Egypt? Maybe it gets contested, but it's 3,500 years ago. I read some technical arguments by people who say, yes, we've got these archaeological finds. They're very technical and lost on me. So, yes, we don't have a lot of evidence of a lot of stuff from 3,000 years ago. So, next question. Is it 3,000 years ago? When exactly did the Exodus happen? So, if it happened, when did it happen? So, here you get a lot of debate. And the debaters basically break out into two camps. You have an early camp that argues that the Exodus took place in the 15th century BC, so 3,500 years ago. And then you have the late dating, which suggested that the Exodus took place in the 13th century BC. If you were listening to the sermon series that I preached, you might remember that I noted that in Exodus, we get the names of some of the women, the midwives, but we don't get the names of the Pharaoh. And that's that's significant and really sort of fun, because you know that the pharaoh would want to be noted and, you know, live on in posterity. But we're not given their name, and so we can't. If we were given their name, the good news would be, the good news about having their name would be, we could date the Exodus, because we've got lists of the pharaohs going back. But there's, you know, you're not, you don't, it's not like you've got, you can go down to the courthouse and just, you know, look through and have exact datings on all these things. And when we're going through thousands of years of history, there's periods in which different insurrections took place, and you got this group called the Hyksos that moved in and seemed to have dominated in Egypt for a while. And you can make the story work with both an early or a late Exodus. I don't spend a lot of time looking at this, but just note there are two dates that get held up, early and a late dating for the Exodus. So 3,200 years ago, 3,400 years ago, those are the dates that we're working with. Next question. It looks like there's a lot of lying going on that gets approved in the Bible. And the Hebrew midwives lied to Pharaoh when they said in verse 19, the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. Moses lies to Pharaoh when he said they just wanted to go out for a week. Neither of these people get in trouble for this. The midwives are commended. What are we to make of the lying that seems to be approved in the book of Exodus? Okay, well, we need to take these one at a time. So let me just say, in terms of the midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, who are part of the celebration of women in the book of Exodus, because we've also got, Jochebed, Moses' mom, we've got Miriam, Moses' sister, we've got Pharaoh's daughter, we've got Moses' wife. There's a number. We get the names and accounts, sort of celebrated accounts of Jewish women. And the midwives get pulled out and they get applauded. So they refuse, as you'll remember. Pharaoh wants the Jewish baby boys that are born to be killed, because he's worried about the growth of the Hebrew population, and that if there's a war, the slaves will all side with the whoever's attacking him, or maybe there will be some insurrection. And so you get these various steps that he's taking towards some sort of genocidal action against the Jews. And the midwives, there's these just two, they're not understood to be just two, but these two get asked by the Pharaoh why they were not killing these baby boys. And they lie to him. At least that's one argument. Some say they're not actually lying. Perhaps it's true that the Hebrew wives, the Hebrew women, were more vigorous and they gave birth more quickly. Okay, maybe. I know nothing about that. The argument here is that we're about to get the Ten Commandments, and the Ten Commandments are going to speak against lying, and Christians are not supposed to lie. And so how do we get this justified? Okay. Look, a couple things. First of all, the Ninth Commandment is going to be the commandment that speaks against lying. And what it says, and we'll look at this in one of the devotions later on. But what it says is, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. So the argument has long been understood that lying to an enemy can be okay. Now, there's a lot that goes into this. Don't think you suddenly have justification to start telling lies. And there's a whole branch of theological ethics that will develop around when it is okay to lie to an enemy. So Rahab is going to lie is going to lie when she is saving the Jewish spies when they're in Jericho. And Moses is going to appear to lie to Pharaoh. I'm not certain if that is when he says, we just want to be gone, go 3 days out and, you know, sacrifice and then come back. There's an argument that says, well, that's actually was initially the plan, but God was sort of testing Pharaoh, and that's all that Moses knew at the time. You will have, and this really rises up and sort of gets its 20th and 21st century articulation in the question, is it ever right for a Christian to lie to a Nazi to save a Jew? And there are some that say no. And if you read Hiding Place with Corrie Ten Boom, you know that Corrie Ten Boom and her sister and her father hide Jews in the hiding place, and eventually they're discovered. But when the Nazis, who have reason to believe that the Booms or the Ten Booms, I don't know what you say there, but when they have reason to believe that the Jews are being hidden in this house, they keep coming in and searching it. And at one point, they asked that they built this hiding place under their kitchen table, and it's you know, covered up, and there's a rug and all this stuff. And at one point, they ask Corrie Ten Boom's sister, "Where are you hiding the Jews? I tell you, where are they hiding?" And she answers, and she says, "Well, they're hiding under the kitchen table." And she tells them the truth. And the Nazi looks under the kitchen table and he thinks that he's being made fun of. And so he, he leaves and he's mad. But she believed that she could not ever tell a lie. So Corrie was in the camp, of which I would also be in the camp, that says, well, there are times when you can lie. And that, you know, playing practical jokes in which you are misleading somebody, or, you know, the defense showing a rush when they're actually going to drop back into zone defense, that none of these things are morally wrong. So there's a lot of these things. Martin Luther King, Dr. King, is going to build a whole sort of adopt, and he gets some of this from Gandhi, but he gets some of this, you know, looking at these women, and he's going to adopt this whole idea of civil disobedience that is going to look at these women and celebrate them, that they are going to, you know, sort of stand up against the enemy. King will argue that you actually, when you're going to violate the law, that you need to do so expecting to be punished, and that you're going to bear that punishment, and that's part of, you know, that was part of his moral leadership. That's, you know, I mean, Nobel Peace Prize winning, profound leadership in the civil rights movement to say we're going to stand up to Bull Connor. We're going to violate these unjust laws. We're going to be beaten with billy clubs doing this, and and shot down with fire, with water from the fire hoses. And we're not going to fight back. I mean, his stand is so exemplary there. He will look to these women, and others will look to these women and saying what they're doing is not wrong, because they are living up to a higher code. And I'll just I'm probably have kept you as long as I can, so I'll just cut to the chase and say that I got asked an ancillary question to this, which is how did they even know that this was wrong? I mean, how did they even decide to lie to Pharaoh, given that the Ten Commandments hadn't been given, and so you don't even have the commandment against murder at this point? How did they know this? Was this an example of something that had just been written on their heart? So I would say yes, and Paul writes about this in Romans chapter 1. There are some things that we cannot not know, because God has written them on our hearts. And we need the special revelation to sort of go further, understand who God is and the moral code that we are to follow. but that there are things that God has written on our heart. And clearly, the idea that Pharaoh, who's really going to, we're going to see this in this whole study, Pharaoh and Egypt are going to become placeholders for evil and darkness. And I'm about to preach a message on judgment, which is actually seeing the upside of judgment. When you've got such a morally reprehensible person. I mean, think about what he's saying. He is saying to women who have chosen to become midwives, which would suggest that they have some part of their heart is given to life and to babies and to the precious nature of birth, and to say to them, hey, if it's a boy, kill it. These are people upon whose heart probably is imprinted the preciousness of life more than others. And so they just know, no, that's just wrong, right? That's just wrong. There are some things we cannot not know. Now, we can, and Paul will write about this in Romans chapter 1, we can suppress the truth. We can harden our hearts. And that is one of the things that we want to be sure not to do. We want to keep our hearts soft to God, to the Spirit of God, to the Word of God, so that we can hear these things and move forward appropriately. So, okay, one more question. Did Moses stutter? So there's a couple situations in which Moses says he doesn't want to, you know, when God calls Moses, Exodus chapter 3, burning bush, you know, you need to go. I've heard the suffering of my people. I've heard their cry. I'm going to send you. You need to go and lead them out of captivity. And Moses says a bunch of things. He has five excuses, but one of them is, I'm not eloquent. I am slow to speak. I have a thick tongue. I mean, it gets translated a variety of different ways. And the question did he stutter? Is this some sort of physical challenge to speaking? And the short answer is, we don't know. Perhaps he did stutter. Perhaps he was scared of public speaking. Perhaps this is just an excuse. Perhaps he looks back at the situation in which he challenged the Hebrew slave who was killing another slave, right, beating him up, and says, why are you doing this? And he doesn't persuade this guy to not do it. There's a variety of different things. In his commentary on Exodus, Leon Cass, who is a sort of the prominent Jewish academic, University of Chicago, Harvard guy. And he wrote a commentary on Genesis, and then he wrote a commentary on Exodus. And in it, he argues, the literal Hebrew here is that Moses says, I am a person of uncircumcised lips. It's a turn of, most people understand this to be a metaphor, a turn of phrase, colorful language. It's not clear whether it means he stutters or he's slow to speak or slow to develop his arguments or whatever it is. Cass argues that one of the things that needs to be considered is Moses is saying that he has not lived faithfully, ritually as a Jew. And so he is not the person that ought to be the spokesman. Okay, well, that's an idea. We don't know. We don't know. So there is no definitive answer to the question, did Moses stutter? Okay, well, as I said, I'm on chapter 3 here. There's lots more questions you've already sent in, and we've got two-thirds of the book, more than that, three-fourths of the book at least that we haven't even taken on. So send in your questions. We'll work through them as we have time. Hope this was helpful. Have a good day.